I'll let the record show. Sam, can we have a tape on you?
Yes. Can you look at this slide quick? I'm not sure how this. Is this all we're looking for?
Yeah.
Okay, we're good. We're
good. Let's move on.
Yep.
All right. Great. So let the record show that we have a quorum of council members present for the meeting. Good morning, everyone. We do have a full agenda today. Hopefully you have all the materials before you. We have a number of updates this morning on different aspects of the Outdoor Heritage Fund regarding receipts into the fund, other funds that are affiliated or associated with the work we do. We're going to get some updates on projects, and then the remaining time we will spend making a decision. This is the one action item beyond the approval of the agenda, where we're going to make a recommendation on which projects, subset of the projects that we receive that we plan to hear further discussion on over the next month and a half or so. Members, I should let you know, too, that Bill got a call last night from Darby's wife, and Darby's in the hospital. He may be here this afternoon, but he had some chest pain and wasn't going away, so he was in the hospital overnight, and according to his wife, he may even try to make it here this afternoon. So just to let you know, that's where Darby is. And Bill, you've heard from any other members?
Senator Anderson has some engagements this morning, but will be in later this morning, is my understanding. And that's about it. We know last week's deer hunting.
Right. And just an update, we still do not have a an appointment yet to replace Bob Troy. So we are at Council of 11. Continue, Scott.
Do we know, is that imminent? Is that...
I don't know. I talked to Bob a couple of weeks ago. Dave, I know you did, Bill, you have as well. And at that point, they still were not at a point where they would announce it.
They're still vetting.
So one of the questions I have is, I know that the rules that we operate under, when we made our recommendations last year, we needed 9 of 12 members. Mm-hmm. Do we need, if that position is not filled, do our recommendations now need 9 of 11 members, or is that 8 of 11 members, seeing as we're one member short in the council?
My interpretation is it's 9 of 11.
And 9 is specified in the statute.
Right. And that's for the recommendations that go to the legislature. Decisions we make today, we need a majority vote of those members present. I also want to welcome Sandy Smith. We're glad to have you on board. Great. Nice to have some assistance provided to Bill. You're welcome. Bill?
But for Sandy being here, we wouldn't be having this meeting today. She's been invaluable.
That's great. Members, I hope you had a chance to look at the agenda for the day. Like a motion to adopt the agenda as proposed. So a motion on the floor to adopt the agenda as proposed. Any discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Agenda is adopted. Second order of business for approval are the meeting minutes from October 19, 2009. Motion to adopt the meeting minutes as drafted. Motion on the table. Any discussion, comments, suggested amendments to the meeting minutes as proposed? Hearing none. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Aye. Meeting minutes are adopted. Bill, your executive director's report.
Thank you, Mike. First of all, I want to turn your attention to the meeting schedule, which you may recall. You've seen this before. We've updated it. It's in your packets. It's got our meetings as scheduled through the end of May of 2010. I found that a frequent reminder as to the existence of that is helpful for all of us, myself included. I'd like to give you a little update on personnel. We are in the process of interviewing for the programmer our program manager or analyst position, we had 47 candidates, I believe. We had screening interviews on 10 last week. It actually was 9 after one took a job in the midst of screening interviews. The second interview is next week. We have 4 candidates. They have legislative and natural resource backgrounds in general, and I'd say they all come highly recommended. We hope to be able to make an offer by the end of next week and have the person, depending on their availability, on board by the beginning of hearings on the 8th, if we begin hearings on the 8th of December. If we have hearings on the 23rd of November, that might be a difficult task to have a person on board. I also want to remind you, the conflict of interest requirements, and in your packet is a conflict of interest form. If you would fill that out at a break or at your leisure, just stick it in the green folder where the expense reports go. Sandy and I will sort things out after the meeting and get your conflict of interest forms on file. We have to keep them on file for the record. And then last, I'd like to talk just a little bit about the revised website. Some of you may have seen it. It's been revised to meet legislative standards, which I approve of. And Sandy is approving the organization. There was some serious reformatting that was necessary from what came over from DNR. All proposals received are on the site. They've been on the site since, I believe, Tuesday after the deadline. Member scores will go on the site on Monday. As you recall, our procedures call for putting individual member scores on all the projects on the website, and they'll be up there on Monday. And as we develop the request hearing schedule, it will go up. One of the things that we've delayed doing for over a year now is getting pictures of the members and perhaps a group picture. Sandy and I have discussed this, and we'd like to arrange for an opportunity for members to have headshots taken by the house photographer in a group shot for the website. And we thought that the best possible day would be the day of allocations. Our assumption is everybody will be here.
We might have some grumpy looking people.
We'll do it early. So sort of plan on that. In addition, we'd like for you to think about a very short bio that can go on the website as well. And with that, Mike, that's the director's report. Unless you have questions or any of the members have questions.
Questions for Bill.
Jim. Bill, could you just give us a brief overview of what this new hire is going to be doing, what the responsibilities are going to be?
Yes, I can. In fact, I can get you the job description. But basically, it'll be assisting and helping you as a council get the kind of proposals or requests that in the shape that you want them in. It'll be reviewing the progress that individual recipients of funds are making on their project and assisting in ensuring that the communications to the council flow in a good way, a plentiful way. So that's the general nature of what this analyst is doing. They'll be working with program managers and be working with Sandy and me to ensure that communications are good, that the projects are being carried out in a forthright manner, forthright manner, I should say. And I think that the last thing is that as all staff, in the event of problems with projects, helping to devise solutions.
You know, one thing, Bill, that I think will be really important for this staff person going forward is that we have projects under our belt and the audits start developing, not only just feedback to the council, but the formal audits done by the legislative auditor and so forth. I think that staff person will play a pretty important role in gathering information regarding and monitoring and evaluating the outcomes of the projects that we recommended.
I'm sure that will take place.
Other questions for Bill?
Rick. Bill, has the, like, is this meeting noticed on the House and the Senate calendar pages?
We have noticed this meeting and received confirmation of notice, but I haven't personally witnessed the notice.
I know that previously when we, during the session, like some of the meetings, we wanted to get on the calendar so that whenever there's meetings, any legislative meeting, it should show up on the calendar, and it wasn't done at that time. And so, like, if you go on the House calendar and click on today, any meetings that are at the Capitol or any legislative meeting that's out in Greater Minnesota should be showing up there so that people can know that it's there. That's what I'm wondering, if it's showing up on that site.
Greg or Janelle?
Well, Mr. Chair and Rick, last year during the session it did not show up. As my understanding, it was because the legislature wasn't allowing this to be on the agenda because it wasn't part of the legislature yet. Other DNR site. But I did notice that every Friday I get an email on a listserv for both Senate and House meetings, and it was on both of those meeting notices. And so I'm assuming because it was on the listserv that it didn't look on the website. But I think all those meetings that come out on the Friday listserv also show up on the legislative website.
And I just wanted to add that there was some confusion on the last meeting with the House when I talked with Mr. LeGrave, and we're a common understanding that this is a legislative body and should be covered. So I think any problems that we had have been solved.
Other questions for Bill?
Great. Thank you, Bill. The next item on the agenda, again, we have now a number of information items for the council. And the first one on the agenda is an update on the Forest Legacy Program. Bill?
Just a little bit on design of the agenda today. The presentations today are contextual information that should come into play when you think about projects you want to hear and eventually allocations.
And just as a backdrop, recall, this is the Upper Mississippi Forest Legacy Project is the one project where allocation from fiscal year 2011 has been made, and that was half of the appropriation for the acquisition of the roughly 200,000 acres of easements on forest land, $18 million. So as we move into making our recommendations, $18 million from fiscal 11 from the Outdoor Heritage Fund has already been made to this project. So with that, Vic, good morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
And if you want to state your name for the record.
My name is Richard Peterson. I am with the Minnesota DNR, and I'm the Forest Legacy Program Coordinator. And I want to thank you. I know you have a busy agenda this morning, and so I'll be brief, but I want to be able to answer any questions you might have. And I really wanted to take the opportunity to brief you on the current status of the Upper Mississippi Forest Project, and then just give a broad overview of our program in general, where we're at and where we might be going in the future. I'll reference a two-sided handout that is in your packet, I believe, and I think that was on your website as well. There's two tables there, and the back side has a map associated with it. First, turn your attention to the top of the page, the table there with the listing of the primary activities associated with the Upper Mississippi Forest Project. Since the first of the fiscal year, we really hit the ground running after the option was signed. We've been busy doing due diligence in a number of areas. As you can well imagine, with a project of this magnitude, almost 190,000 acres, over 4,000 separate parcels, the legal description alone took over 150 pages. The title work, which was primarily well facilitated by the title company, most of it was available on the website, but still over well over 1,000 pages of documents to examine. And so we're busy with that process. The preliminary title has been completed. The environmental assessment has been done. It will be updated prior to closing. You can see through the checklist there The option has been signed. The legal description is completed. I've spent several weeks up there since July 1, visiting the property, assembling information for the baseline property report, beginning to develop the monitoring plan. So I would say at this stage of the game, we're well ahead of our planned schedule for completing the project. We've got a tentative closing date there. I think it's fairly firm, actually, a mid-July closing of next summer. If no complications arise, and at this point I don't see any on the horizon, I think we're well within our scheduled closing date of getting everything accomplished. Any questions, I guess, from the chair or members on this particular project?
Yeah, Jim, please.
Mr. Peterson, I was just curious, was this property open to public use this fall? And how will the public know that this property is available for public use in the future?
Mr. Chair, members, good question. It was open to the public. I encountered grouse and archery hunters up there this fall. Every time I was up there, there were hunters either actively hunting or looking for places to do the firearm deer season hunt. If you look on our in our website, all of our Forest Legacy projects that are open to the public are listed as public hunting opportunities with a map associated with it. And I suspect we will have something very similar to that for this project. In addition to that, whatever the LSOHC website will accommodate, we'll certainly put the same information on that website. We may also have signage. There are several disjunct parcels, so signage of every single parcel will be difficult, at least maybe on the main entrance roads. We may have some signage that will indicate that it continues to be open to the public.
Dick, you have it here. Could you refresh my memory on the matching funds? So the legislature appropriated $36 million to this project. Can you refresh the council members of the other matching funds for this?
Sure. The other matching funds are available through the conservation fund, and that amount is $9 million. And their funds are basically going to be provided at closing. And all of their funds will, you know, for example, if for whatever reason we only spent $44 million total, we would still spend all of the $9 million in matching funds.
And so that $9 million, I know that the Blandon Foundation provided a chunk of that $9
million. $7 million was from the Blandon Foundation and $2 million from a separate foundation. And I believe Tom Duffus is in the audience here and could provide more detail on any additional information you're looking for.
Thank you. Another question I had, Dick, if you could help me out. You have in here an activity called Baseline. Can you tell the council a little bit more about what that all entails?
Sure. As part of any easement project, a baseline property report is assembled, and that is a picture in time of the property at the time of closing. So we start assembling it in advance of closing, update the information at closing, but it really is a combination of written reports, tables, lots of maps, and photography that provide a description of the property at closing, and which is the basis for monitoring the property over time. So, for example, if we document that there are no buildings on the property through the baseline property report, that will form a foundation for monitoring over time, and if there were buildings erected at a later date, that would be in contradiction to the easement terms, and we'd have the property report as evidence that there were no buildings at close.
Does that also include, then, an inventory of the vegetation?
On the property? to a limited degree. It will include a cover type inventory, which is a map inventory of the forest units that are out there, the plant community types and the forest community types that are on the property.
Sure. Follow up on that. So has the property had the land cover mapping that's been done in other counties around the state? Has that already been done?
For other projects, are you asking, or for this particular?
For this particular project.
The Blandon foresters do have a cover type map for this property already. And that will likely be part of our property report. And that certainly will have to be updated since they're obviously continually changing as a result of harvesting and other timber management activities.
And then to follow up, has there been any, has the property been LIDAR mapped or high resolution photography mapped?
Not to my knowledge, no. There is not associated directly with this project, but the Division of Forestry Resource Assessment Unit is flying color infrared, or has flown already this fall, new color infrared photography for two or three of the counties, the primary counties, Itasca and Acushnet County, have brand new color infrared photography flown this fall, which will help be part of the baseline. All of the other photography will be no older than 1 or 2 years. So current and up-to-date photography is very important part of the baseline.
I think particularly for two subjects that we've had a lot of discussion on here, one is permanent deer stands that are established on the property, if they're established on the property, and if more are established. And the second is trails being established, ATV trails. That may not be there. If either of those aren't there now, and then they start to appear, what happens if both of those things start to occur in the property?
In the first case, as far as I know, there are, well, Langdon right now does not allow permanent deer stands in the property. So in the couple hundred hours that I've spent up there since the beginning of July, I've yet to encounter a permanent deer stand. There are, and I've seen a handful of, we'll call them rogue ATV trails that go over, but they're primarily going in on old logging trails. I have not seen any roads through the woods, for example, off trail roads created by ATVs. But it's a large property. I don't know that photography of the type that the resource assessment folks would gather would show those types of trails unless they were extremely large. Typically, they would show up in that type of photography.
Any other questions for Mr. Peterson on the planning project? Jim?
Just one quick one. Mr. Peterson, if this property should change hands, will the new owners have any ability whatsoever to negotiate any changes in this easement?
Chair members, I won't say there's absolutely no possibility. Our easements are considered fixed in time, that is unchangeable. There is an amendment process that, in an eventuality that a change is maybe necessary, that we could amend an easement. But that would be an extraordinary circumstance. It would not be commonplace to amend and change an easement. So we don't anticipate. We wouldn't, for example, the current easement does not allow any structures, residences on the property. We certainly wouldn't amend the easement to allow residents on the property.
Sure. What is the status of potential sale of the property?
I'm not aware of any developments there. The company hasn't invited any people like Mike who might not be going on to sell it just to sale of the property.
Finally, is the signed easement available online anywhere, or is that public information?
We we have not posted it online in any particular place. It is public information, and certainly could be requested from me.
I think it would be a good idea, Mr. Peterson, if you get Bill a copy of the meeting. It sounds like at least one member, maybe more, would like to take a look at
that. I'll forward that on to Gary.
But it's not signed yet.
The
option.
Right.
The option to have that is
right. Any other questions on the Blandon project?
And then just real briefly here, although the UPM Blandon project has occupied a lot of our time and attention, we're certainly busy with other projects. We have a as large now, well, or half the size. The Kuchiching project at 76,500 acres is an active project in Kuchiching County with the Boise, the old Boise Timberlands, and we received a total of about just under $10 million from the feds to procure that easement. And so we expect to close on that easement by the end of June this year. In addition to that project, we're busy in the southwest on five small landowner projects totaling about 1,900 acres. Those projects were funded by LCCMR and are actively doing fieldwork baseline reporting on that, those projects right now. And then, again, in reference to the map on the backside, it's good to be here and not ask for money this year. But we do have a considerable backlog of opportunities out there. Some 20 projects are listed on the map. About half of those are in the northern forest, a handful in the southwest, a couple in the big woods, and a nice project in the metro area of 600 acres or so. So we're excited about future opportunities and potential projects that we have currently on our list and new projects that will undoubtedly develop over the next couple of years. So I think it's a good time to sit back and look at what we might be looking at in the future, and hopefully over the next 6 months or so we'll do some additional planning to probably put a proposal in for next year.
Are you going to be around through the day, or are you heading out?
I've got some field work scheduled this afternoon, but I can certainly make myself available if there was something.
I had a question about one of the proposals that I can maybe talk to him offline.
I think I know which one it is. And I think that would be good information for all of us. Any other questions for Mr. Peterson? If not, thank you very much for the update.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
The next item on our agenda is we are going to get an update on the Fiscal 10 and Fiscal 11 appropriations from the other funds. Bill, before we introduce Greg and Dan to provide us that, any comments?
In the first meeting following the end of the session, it was agreed that we would take a look at how all the other funds were used. We've delayed that until this meeting. This is the information that I think has some bearing on what you found. I think the most important thing to remember about this is that in the other funds, both fiscal years have been appropriated, so there's no recommendations that I know of going through the legislature for the Clean Water Fund, the Parks and Trails Fund, or anything like that. So this is the context in which you're making your recommendations. We've been asked to coordinate, so knowledge of what they're doing is important to have when we make our decisions.
Great. Good morning, Dan. Greg. Come on.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Dan Mueller. I'm a fiscal analyst for the Minnesota Senate. I work on the Environment and Natural Resources Committee and the Ag and Vets Committee, and work on the committees that together the final proposals for the constitutional dedicated funding.
And Mr. Chairman, Greg Knapp, Senate analyst. How we proceed today is Dan put together the spreadsheet that you all have in your packet and go through it. And if you have any questions, I'm going to probably be pretty silent unless you need me to answer any questions related to any of these projects.
Mr. Chairman, the table I'm working off of, it's hopefully in your packet. It's a 7-page document. And just to clarify, it's not really an update of what was appropriated last year. It's more of a review of what was appropriated last year. I have a update from finance from end of September of any of the money that's gone out so far on these dedicated funds. But as you probably know, very little has actually gone out yet, other than some small spending within some of the state agencies. But to start off with, we'll obviously glance over the Outdoor Heritage Fund, which was the Article 1 in Chapter 172. And that is pretty much the first page of this document. And just to put things in context, of course, Outdoor Heritage Fund, the final appropriations were $69.53 million in fiscal year 10 and $18 million in fiscal year 11, of course, for the forest, for the future program. And I believe you've had some discussions already about the revenue that will be available for the fiscal year 11 and waiting on the November forecast to sort of nail that down. So I won't really spend too much time on that other than showing that the appropriations that we made last year, if you see down the line 50, left a fund balance of pretty close to 10% in fiscal year 10. And you've probably heard already the sales tax so far running about over 2% low for fiscal year 10, and we'll find out from the forecast that's expected to continue through fiscal year 10 and 11, or increase or decrease. So, and then there's a expected fund balance at the end of fiscal year 2011 of about $63.5 million. Actually, it would be about $71.2 million when you add the fund balance for the 2 years together.
So that doesn't take into account the roughly 10% that is held back in the reserve account in fiscal 10.
Madam, or Mr. Chairman, sorry. The 10% is listed there on line 50 under fiscal year 10, the $7.7 million. That's the roughly 10% that was, it really wasn't put aside in the reserve account. It's just left unspent and carried forward as a reserve.
Mr. Mueller, I may have missed it. The $77,000 and the $81,000, are those February forecasts? Or what's the forecast date that those come from?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, members, yes, it's listed on line 48 there. I say it's the February 2009 forecast is all the revenue numbers we have here. So I haven't tried projecting what the new forecast is going to say yet.
I apologize. I put my sticky note over
that. On the page 2, is, on the top of it, lines 52 through 58 or 59 is just a summary by fiscal agency of the Outdoor Heritage Fund. The way this whole table is structured is I'm going into detail about the what each fund is doing, and then at the end of each appropriation fund table, I have a summary by agency of the appropriation. So again, that's the same total there, just a total by agency. You see the vast majority of the money is flowing through the Department of Natural Resources, at least as a fiscal agent for all these funds, for tracking wise.
And Mr. Mueller, the amount of money flowing through the DNR includes the pass-throughs that are nominally appropriated to non-governmental organizations or local needs of government?
Mr. Chairman, members, yes. As you see it back on page 1, on column C, I listed, especially for this fund, agency and organization as stated in the legislation where the money is going to, but for my purposes and how I think of things, I more think of things of how they go through an agency. That's how we track things officially through finance, but I tried listing on column C there what organization was also mentioned in the appropriations.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members, continuing on to page 2, line 61, we go through the Clean Water Fund. And the way I've sorted this right now is a by function. It's kind of putting things more like how this council and the LCCMR sort of shows things by function instead of by agency, even though the actual appropriation bill appropriated all the money by agency. I kind of resorted things by function. It's a little bit easier way to conceptualize the broad categories of where the money went out for clean water. So on line 63 is the non-point source protection and preservation. This is largely, as you'll see there, the money that goes to Bowser for the non-point cost share programs and the various grants that is meant to protect water through non-point protection programs. Bowser was by far the biggest recipient of appropriations in this area. And you see DNR had a couple programs, had a couple appropriations. And PCA also had their biggest one here, the $2.5 million appropriation. But some of these things also get general fund dollars through the regular appropriation process, including the Clean Water Partnership grant through PCA. They also get about $4.7 million of general fund dollars. And another one, back up in Bowser, their feedlot, there's another feedlot program that we run through Bowser, or through PCA. You'll see on line 76, there's $4 million for feedlot and water quality assessment grants. We also do a $4.3 million general fund program through PCA for feedlot programs, too. So, but this is all supposed to be money that's on top of course, not supplanting any other general fund appropriations that regularly go through any of the agencies. The other last one I'll note, the Department of Ag, that's on line 88. MDA is the Department of Ag and the Ag BMP program. That in the past has received some general fund dollars, but here we're using clean water money. So total of almost $45 million for non-point source protection and preservation. On to line 93, the point source protection. This is mostly the money that goes to the Public Facilities Authority for their projects dealing with wastewater treatment plants. So the three big grant programs they have are the TMDL grant programs, the phosphorus reduction grants, and the small community wastewater treatment program. And then there's a little bit of money we ran that was appropriated to the PCA just for some pilot projects to reuse wastewater that are at wastewater plants and to reuse them in other industrial purposes. So we have $37.36 million for point source programs. The next broad category under Clean Water Fund is assessment, monitoring, and TMDL development. So this is largely the money that flows through PCA and DNR to do their assessments and then do their TMDLs. This follows a process of a 10-year time frame of getting all the waters in the state assessed and then start establishing the TMDLs for these all those waters that are found to need them.
Mr. Mueller, maybe Greg, you can help me out. On line 107, the St. Clair watershed monitoring, I don't recall why a specific watershed monitoring appropriation was made when you have a large, seems like a statewide water quality. Can you recall from the discussion why St. Croix watershed was there something unique about that, why it was appropriated money for monitoring itself? Rick, maybe, or Representative Guther?
Special.
Obviously, very special.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, for the most part, you'll see that the appropriations did go up for the broad categories of assessment from TMDL development to the agency and let them go through their normal process of assessing waters. A couple of specific programs were mentioned, either because they're working with some different people. I think that the St. Croix one, they're doing some work with the state of Wisconsin also on monitoring.
And Mr. Chairman, in the National Park Service.
Yeah. And, it could be argued that some of that would have happened anyways if we would just put all the money up into the broad category, but some projects were listed individually, and for the most part, they were pretty small for the dollar amounts.
I like that.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I could probably just add that there was a provision in there that said that it's only appropriations are only available to the extent matched. So Wisconsin and National Park Service don't come up with a like amount of money together that might come out of the
Mr. Chairman, then similar on 9109 for TMDL development. This again is the money that goes through the TCA to do their normal TMDL development. And there's two separate special projects listed underneath that, the Minnesota River Water Quality Testing and the Coastal River Watershed. The next, the DNR receives a little bit of money under the assessment and monitoring. They also do some work on assessing the lakes and developing TMDLs. And this piggybacks on previous general fund appropriation, one-time general fund appropriations that would go through these agencies that worked on assessments and TMDL development. And the last agency is the Department of Ag. A lot of the work they do in working on assessments is on pesticides and things like that. So yep. They receive a little bit of money in that area.
Mr. Mueller, back to the DNR, I think you said lake assessment, part of that water quality assessment and monitoring. You mentioned some general fund money that was once a one-time appropriation.
Mr. Chairman and members, I don't have the exact numbers. I have the totals of how much one-time general fund dollars that went to the whole clean water sort of category in past years. I don't know how much went, I don't have it off the top of my head, how much went to each agency. These are significantly more dollars that went to each agency based on compared to the general fund dollars that went previously. But those general fund dollars were one time and were never in any base budget. And so they were kind of switched over to clean water funding. And I think it was always the assumption most people around here that clean water funding would take up the balance of those work by those agencies that used to be funded by one-time general fund dollars.
So this was an appropriation in FY7 or FY8, and that's it.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman and members, just comparison to previous bienniums in fiscal year 08 and 09, a total of $52.2 million of one-time general fund dollars went into clean water legacy programs. And then back in fiscal year 07, we took about $15 million into it. So it was after the Clean Water Legacy Act passed, and then we started ramping up some money before the constitutional money became available. We did put some one-time general fund dollars into these areas, but you know, in comparison to what is being appropriated now, like I said, the previous biennium was $52 million, and as you'll see here, the total now is for the buy-in of 10 and 11 is $150 million.
Mr. Mueller, looking back up on line 70, and this is one of, I'm sure, several that, as members of the Outdoor Heritage Council, we would have an interest in this. The water at Carrying Buffer seem to be somewhat in the same mission that we're looking at as it relates to habitat. But could you tell us, or maybe Mr. Knopf, a little bit more about what that appropriation is for?
I'll make one point before Greg goes on. I have to remember that the programs that are funded by the Clean Water Fund do not have some of the same restrictions are that some of the programs that could be funded with this agency won't be open for, hunting and fishing and things like that. So with the Clean Water Fund, there's less restrictions, and the money can go for different projects that would probably be available or be appropriated from this council and from this fund.
Mr. Chairman, what that's for is they're going to purchase and restore permanent conservation easements on riparian buffers of about 100 feet adjacent to public waters, excluding wetlands, to keep water in the land or decrease sediment, pollutant, and nutrient transport, reduce hydrologic impacts to surface waters, and increase infiltration for groundwater recharge. That's the main purpose of it. Therefore, for buffers of up to 100 feet on public waters.
And so they would follow a similar process like they did with the WRP RIM, where they have a call and they identify willing landowners and then
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think these will all be probably run through their soil and water conservation. So, although it doesn't say that, but it could be done through a comment or something like that. But I'm assuming that I've not checked with Bowser recently to see how they've progressed in this program. But I'm guessing that they're still gathering the project right now.
This goes up with what we've been doing the last few years of adding more buffer projects. And then the water retention, 171, goes to some of the watershed districts as well for holding water projects, trying to keep it on the ground. And we felt with the WDs, they had the taxing authority that they could match that. We have general fund projects for buffer cost share for establishment of native vegetation on the buffer. So you match, you can take the general fund, the cost share money, to help establish some of those seedings, then you've got the easement that's there as well. So
this appropriation is just an easement?
This is easement, and I think in addition, it has some other.
It does also,
broader.
Mr. Chairman, Rick, it does talk about restoration to the land subject to the. So some of this money could be spent on that.
When we put the two together, we're doing an extensive investment in buffers.
I'm just curious. I mean, there's a lot of money going into that, which is great. Any sense on the number of miles of these 100-foot buffers that they might be able to get from the easement in this way?
Mr. Chairman, without having Bowser here, no, I wouldn't want to speculate on that, but I'm sure they could come and report on some of those projects. Maybe that might even be a good idea to have Bowser come in here and talk about some of these projects that might cross over in gray areas between what this council is proposing.
We have some of the numbers for that. Bowser had numbers last during the session of by county amount of potential buffers that were under crop that could be buffered. We directed in the tax bill a study of buffers and the opportunities that are going. Actually, this afternoon, Greg is going to go to that, but there's a great work group meeting this afternoon. They were charged specifically to come up with a report to the legislature by, say, 15th of January or 30th of January on buffer opportunities, and then also looking at the tax question, because how buffers are taxed from county to county varies. Some If we put a buffer in that has an easement, whether it's a temporary CRP easement or a long-term easement such as this, in one county that has ag land, and in another county adjoining it, the same system can be taxed as basic. And so that question of how taxation occurs on these buffers, whether they're on drainage systems or whether they're riparian areas with rivers and streams, that's what we were looking for, and there's an advisory group that Bowser set up that's meeting in conjunction with the drainage work group. So you have layering of work groups that are here, and it may be something for a future meeting to have an update on what's going on.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, to finish off on page 2 here, the total for assessment and monitoring is $41.6 million. On page 3, we have sort of a new area that in previous general fund appropriations for clean water, you didn't do a whole lot for ground and drinking water protection. And so a lot of this money is truly, some money is spent by PCA, DNR, and even Department of Health for ground and drinking water assessment and protection. And this is all money on top of that, but previously under the banner of clean water appropriations, we haven't really put anything into this category. And the Constitution that passed, or the question that passed, required that at least 5% of the clean water fund money go for a drinking water protection program, groundwater and drinking water protection program. You'll see there on line 123, for fiscal year 2011, the legislature made a $5 million appropriation to PCA and is requiring PCA to come back to the legislature this year with a little bit more detail. It's sort of a set-aside of
about $5 million for groundwater and drinking water protection. That's not specific about how it's really going to be spent. The PCA is supposed to work with the various agencies that normally receive money in this area and put together a better plan for how they will spend how they would spend $5 million of additional money in fiscal year 2011. Otherwise than that, we appropriated about $5.1 million in fiscal year 2010. Some of that to PCA, some to DNR. The Department of Health received a pretty big increase on the amount of monitoring that they will be doing. Met Council received a little bit of money to put together a water supply plan for the metro area. Bowser again got some about $2 million for wellhead protection areas. And then the Department of Ag also does some drinking water protection work. And that is about $15.6 million total for the biennium, which is actually about 10% of the money that was appropriated for the program. So it doubles what was required in the constitutional question. Line 137, it was one of the categories, is education and public engagement. We put a little bit of money to PCA for this. Some of the advocacy groups wanted a significant more money in this area for now, but until there's maybe a better plan and how the moving ahead with a better plan about how they would spend this money, the legislature appropriated just a small amount in this area. The last area, line 143, is another category that we sort of created called research and tool development. There's about $10.9 million appropriated in that area. You'll see there the Department of Ag has about $2.2 million. The University of Minnesota, the line 148, had a $750,000 appropriation to put together a water resources framework study to kind of look ahead about and give the legislature a better idea of where the money is needed over the next 20 years. 25 years. And you'll see there's similar reports requested in some of the other funds. We can kind of all, and maybe this, some of these reports will help work together too, across funds too, about what can be, should be spent in what certain areas. But that report is coming. So they have some time to work on that report. But before the next legislative process, appropriating money for the fund. The U of M and DNR received some money for geological atlas surveys and high-resolution the LIDAR work, and again, some of that has been appropriated through the LCCMR before, and this goes on top of what they have appropriated. And the last area is PCA received about $1 million for $500,000 for an enhanced database, and then working on some coal tar best management practices. The last area, the small appropriation to the Legislative Coordinating Commission, who's working on sort of the all-inclusive website that is supposed to, through using information from all the funds. They received $25,000 from the Clean Water Fund and also Heritage Fund. $10,000, and they got a little bit of money from all the funds. So total is, again, $150.8 million for the 2 years. They left a 10% fund balance in fiscal year 10 that would carry over to 11, which should be enough to absorb the any decrease in sales tax revenue. So unless finance has some other recommendations, it's probably unlikely they have to adjust any of the appropriations, at least to meet revenue forecasts. The legislature could decide to adjust some appropriations for other reasons in 10 or 11, but they probably left themselves enough cushion to absorb any of the revenue shortfalls, at least for this one.
I just wanted to mention, as long as it came up, the public information website from LCC and the $10,000 that was appropriated out of the Outdoor Heritage Fund
We've been working closely with LPC GIS staff who are developing it to ensure that it, to the extent possible, which I think is significant, can accommodate our proposals and also our projects as they get underway. The vision is an interactive database for data entry by project managers on a case basis, where a case might be an acquisition or a restoration or an enhancement.
Please continue.
Mr. Chairman, on the bottom of page 3, again, is this a recap of the fund appropriations, and this is by agency, so you can see how much money is flowing through each agency. The PCA, you know, $51.1 million or $21.2 million. So they get almost a third of the Clean Water Fund appropriations that are flowing through the PCA. DNR is on line 185. It's $14.5 million. Back on page 4, Board of Water and Soil Resources, Bowser is getting about $38.2 million over the 2 years. On line 197, the Department of Ag is getting 8.96. On line 200, the Public Facilities Authority is getting 32.7. And you can see the other agencies, the Met Council, the Department of Health, Legislative Coordinating Commission, and the University of Minnesota, in their respective totals, again, for a total of $150.8 million over the 2 years. Again, to put in perspective of what we did with general fund dollars in previous bienniums, we did $52.2 million in fiscal year 08 and 09, and $15 million in fiscal year 07, was sort of the first year that the legislators started making appropriations for these programs.
Could you give me those numbers again?
Sure. It was $52.2 million in fiscal year 2008 and 09 biennium. And that includes all the legislative reductions and unallotments for some of those programs. I think originally there was almost $55 or $54 million that was appropriated. Some of it was unallotted and or reduced by previous legislatures to help balance the budgets. And then in fiscal year 07, sort of the first year, the legislature started putting money toward these programs. It was $15 million.
Oh, I'm sorry, Rick, please comment. I think there's been some public commentary about money not being spent on actual water protection in some places. And I think it's important to look at the Bowser allocation, particularly because those are projects that go into the ground. They're actual real projects and studies that are things that, in order to protect water quality, you've got to be able to manage soil and so those grants that go out, and they can go out relatively quickly, will have a big impact on water quality, particularly looking at buffers and stream bank stabilization, and in the groundwater area, the wellhead protection valve. So I think it's important to answer that question, that there is money that has gone out into the grant programs, will go into projects that should have water quality benefits. Relatively quickly in some of these areas where there's been erosion, where there's been turbidity, and a variety of contaminants that are out there. Some of them that are chemical, may have a greater lag time effect, and some of these you can see some effect relatively quickly when they're studying the extent of erosion can be produced.
Well, Mr. Chairman, and I'll get point two, I want to point out the $32.7 million that's going out to Public Facilities Authority, and that's real projects too, at wastewater treatment plants and to communities that are trying to do things to protect their direct runoff going directly into streams and lakes too. So none of that money is going to study either. So. If that is it for clean water, on the page 5 is a one page for the Parks and Trails Fund. And they appropriated a total of $65 million over the 2 years. The sort of the four categories of spending are for $27.8 million for state parks and trails. That goes to the DNR networks. You pretty much have a set program and backlog of lists of projects for how that money goes out. The regional parks program on line 220 is for non-state parks throughout the state, and this is $8.87 million goes out for that, and part of that, $1.1 million, is for solar projects. And DNR is working on a grant process for getting this money out, either to the non-state parks, but these are supposed to be parks and trails of statewide and regional significance.
Mr. Mueller, Mr. Knopf, do you have any recollection of these appropriations of the state and the regional parks? How much of it is, if any, is for habitat work or vegetative management work? Or is it acquisition or trail development?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't have it's not really broken down by percentage. I know I've seen some things from the last session from state parks and trails on how they're going to allocate some of these dollars. But there definitely is money that's going to be spent on that. If you, the second item, if you look at the appropriation, the line number you see in 218, accelerate natural resource management, restoration, and protection activities in state parks, including restoring these 500 additional acres of state parkland, conducting invasive species detection and prevention, providing rapid response to terrestrial aquatic invasive species detection, conducting prescribed burns on an additional 6,000 acres, restoring and managing native prairies and woodlands along at least 6% of the developed miles of state trails. And so those are, I mean, it does include money for that, although it's not really broken down in the law. But I know that they have a list of items, and I'm sure that DNR could break down how much that would cost.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, then on to line 224, the Metro Parks and Trails, the total amount of money going out there is $27.78 million for Metro Parks and Trails. And again, there's a pretty much a set process, a formula that we actually put into the bill about how the money's going out to the different Metro Parks that are part of the Metro Parks program. And they have a whole backlog of projects and everything, too. And I think some, although we didn't put it into the bill as much like we did with the state parks programs about how prescribed burns and all that, the Metro Parks has a set list of the ways that they're going to spend that money, too. And I'm sure I could give a report on that also. The last part there, line 226, is again the framework and inventory report that is being put together by the U of M and working in collaboration with the DNR. Sort of the same thing that was happening with the Clean Water Fund. We're asking for a report and give the legislature a little bit more guidance looking ahead of where could be some of the areas that funding is needed for in the parks area. And again, none of these numbers are baseline. When the next legislature in 2011 comes back, they'll start all over again. And so the split between how much go to state parks and metro parks and regional parks, none of this was all one-time funding in the bill, and none of this should be expected to be baseline funding for any of the program areas. The last one there, again, line 231, as we talked about, so $15,000 was given to LCC to help work on their overall website with the funds. And then the last part of this page, again, is just a summary by agency of where the $65 million of Parks and Trails money is going. Most of it to the DNR, $36.9 million to the DNR and $27.8 million to the Met Council. The last area, just as a, spent a whole lot of time on the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, but just to keep things in perspective, this whole table summarizes all the four funds that were part of the constitutional amendment, and they're all part of Chapter 172. So I'll quickly go through the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Line 253 is $43.3 million to the Board of Arts. line 273, 22 million to the Minnesota Historical Society. On 275, the couple different programs, the money is being run through the Department of Administration. The first three lines, 276 to 279, are for public TV and public radio. And then the next three there are money for the Children's Museum, the Science Museum, and the Minnesota Zoo also received a little bit of money through the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. The Humanities Center on line 295 received $2.1 million. The Indian Affairs Council on line 299 is $1.9 million. Privet Center for the Arts, $1 million. And then $8.5 million went out to regional, county, and public libraries. So that's in addition to any funding they get. I believe the K-12 education bill appropriates general fund money to county and regional libraries, so this is money on top of that they would otherwise get. So a total of $93.2 million out of the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. The last page has a summary showing all the four funds, the total. So you can see that there on lines 322 to 326 and how much was appropriated from each fund. It was, in chapter 172, it was close to $400 million from the four funds was appropriated, and for the most part, other than the Outdoor Heritage Fund, the other three funds all had 2 years of appropriations, and the Outdoor Heritage Fund just had that $18 million appropriation. So we add on to whatever the appropriations will be from this council looking forward. We're looking at, you know, close to $450 million over a two-year period from the four funds. And then the last part there, again, is the same total broken down by agency. That includes all the funds, so that is it.
Mr. Mueller, Mr. Knopf, thank you. This is really helpful, and I guess I'd just a minute turn to council members for questions. One thing that this brought to my attention is that it's on our list of future agenda items is to have some of those projects that have a direct habitat piece to it, things that you talked about, Mr. Mueller, the riparian buffers, could be the grant or the appropriations to the state, the regional, and the metropolitan parks, just to get a better understanding of what else is being done through these other funds that directly relate to fish, game, and wildlife habitat. To get a better understanding of what's at play beyond just the Outdoor Heritage Fund. Members? Oh, yes, wait.
If I could, Mr. Chair, I'd like to have a short question and answer for you here, because I've got some concerns about these different pots of money that are all over the place. And something that I've driven around the country, I still notice that we still have livestock which have access to lakes and wetlands across Minnesota. We have grazing still along riparian areas, and we are still plowing next to riverbanks, and we still have building activities in sensitive areas. So we've got a lot of things that are still occurring out there, and I'm wondering, are there laws already on the books that are protecting lake shores, wetlands, riparian areas? And are we using dedicated dollars to fund protection of land that already is protected by law because we have laws on the books? And so therefore, we have agencies which are not doing their job and basically not avoiding the law and not doing what they're supposed to be doing. And so if we have laws that are already enforced, if they were enforced, would we need to be spending the money we're sending? And then on top of all that, I'm wondering if to get the maximum use of our dollars that we are spending, and one, if we enforce the laws that we already have on the books and work with every county, state, and federal agency that's out there to maximize our return for our investment, wouldn't we be better off? I don't think, we know that CRP has a continuous CRP program, and it also has CT13 and marginal pasture provisions, which can protect a lot of these acres, riparian areas. And are we utilizing those, or are we just going out and putting permanent easements on things which maybe we don't really need to do that? I know there's a lot of questions.
Well, those are some very good questions, and I don't have the answer to them, but so I would defer to Mr. Knopf or Ms. Taylor, or anyone else for that matter, Ms. Mueller. I guess the big question is, you know, the extent to which laws and ordinances exist that might already protect some of those key areas that are being funded through this.
Mr. Chairman, there has been some discussion recently over the shoreline zoning. It does require, I don't have it in front of me, it's supposed to be, I think, a 50-foot buffer on public waters. But that doesn't include all wetlands. It's only wetlands over 10 acres in rural parts of the state, over 2.5 acres in an urban setting. As I understand it, you see that buffer program is supposed to be up to 100. They take nothing less than 50. So really what you're trying to do is you're trying to get a wider buffer than what even be required. But I've heard a lot of discussion lately about a lack of local enforcement over the 50-foot requirement. And again, I don't know. I've not looked specifically at the language recently to see how if there are some outs in there. The other one that people often discuss is drainage ditches. The buffer requirement, the one on drainage ditches. And that was actually the subject of legislation that Ripley Hansen was involved in a few years ago to kind of better define for that one. But you got to remember with drainage ditches, it's only after they've done a redetermination of benefits. And so unless a drainage ditch has gone through redetermination of benefits, I think it's after 1959. I don't remember the exact date. But after a certain date when that requirement was put in place, they're not required to have a buffer unless they've gone through their redetermination of benefits.
Well, Greg, do you think it's possible we could get at least a definition or a copy of what the laws are in Minnesota so that we know when we are protecting something which is already should be done? I mean, it doesn't have to be the whole law, but then...
See, Mr. Chairman, you've got it right behind Mike.
Right here.
Yeah, and basically a breakdown of what it is, because quite frankly, it wasn't too many years ago. I went before the county commissioners, and I had asked about my concerns on some wetlands which were still being grazed across while cows, they don't stop defecating and urinating when on the land, they go in the water and everywhere else. And people fishing downstream from it. I had a real concern about that, and the basic response was, yes, but this is their livelihood, and we really don't want to be harming that. And I'm thinking, well, wait a minute, isn't law set up to benefit all people? And we can't start picking and choosing who people now. That doesn't, I'm an advocate for agriculture and everything else, but there still is some things I think that are on the books that need to be addressed and looked at before we start spending money on things that maybe all we need to do is have enforcement by MPCA or the state.
Bill, just kind of on that point, is there an opportunity for another thing to put on our future agenda list to look at least the buffer piece and what laws the buffers?
Mr. Chair, I'll contact Board of Water Soil Resources, Ag and DNR, and see if they can come up with a presentation on the laws and the status and answer some of our questions.
And one more question. Could we also?
I think if we could get that, it would be helpful not only to understand what the buffer requirements in different places, and there are a lot of different places. Is it a state road or a county road or whatever? But who's responsible for the enforcement? Because there's a huge issue with who's on the hook for enforcing it as to whether it gets enforced. So you're not looking at both of them together. You missed the big picture.
That's it, yeah.
And so Wayne?
I lost my train of thought.
I'm sorry.
Also, at some point or another, we've talked to different agencies. Could we have maybe a representative from all of the agencies across Minnesota that deal with buffers and to just come in and give a 5-minute presentation on what they do? Because we haven't heard from all of them. We've had some of them come in and talk about it, but we do know that NRCS is having involved with creating plans for those. We know that FSA has different projects which are available. We have state conservation funds. We have forestry funds from all these different organizations that are there to help protect these things. And maybe instead of us going out and looking at each agency working on these individually, especially on the buffers and things, this would be a great opportunity to piggyback all of them to see what we can do together to make it to speed this process up, because our dollars are limited. There might be some other agencies that have a lot more dollars to be
able. Good suggestion. I know Bill's been taking notes on that. Thanks.
Rick? I think it's important to note, beyond the appropriations that are here, that there is policy language that was passed on what the funds can be used for. Specifically, in the Clean Water Fund, it says the Clean Water Fund could be used for increased enforcement. So that's the law, that there are projects that could be done for increased enforcement, not what people are supposed to already be doing, but the fund, the use of the fund can be used for increased enforcement. And that was different than what came from the recommendation from the Clean Water Council. That was a legislative initiative, because we've been listening to these issues for years in terms of who should do things. So the use of enforcement for the Clean Water Fund, according to statute, is an appropriate use, is an appropriate use of the Clean Water Fund. And it will take money, because when you open up this can of worms, you're going to find the counties and the cities that are all going to be right here saying they don't have any money to do anything, and that we have a local control effort. As far as the drainage buffers, there's a report that the taxpayers of Minnesota spent tens of thousands of dollars on 4 years ago. You can get that available. Like I said, there is an ongoing drainage work group that's been going, meeting for 4 years on this particular issue, in this meeting this afternoon. The legislature took action in the tax bill to establish the tax issue. And the reason for this is that, like Mr. Knopf said, the shoreline rule, there is not a statute that says thou shalt must have a 50-foot buffer on all riparian areas. The shoreline rules apply in some cases, but in terms of most, that doesn't apply. The drainage ones, it's after 1977. So we have drainage ditches that are established in the 1920s that have not gone through a redetermination of benefits. You see an initiative that occurs with leadership at the local level. For example, Freeborn County, their county auditor says, we're going to go through and do a redetermination of benefits on every drainage ditch. Then that forces the buffer, and you have an updated evaluation. But you may have an adjoining county that says that that's impossible to do. It's possible in one county, but impossible to do in another county. The taxation issue, voluntary buffers, which most of the buffers still are voluntary. That's why we put the money in. We have the money in, we don't have the requirements there. So taxation policy, enforcement policy, clarification of buffers. We also require that people put and file to report back to the legislature how many enforcement actions they've taken, so that there is transparency in terms of who's actually doing what in terms of blocking out there and looking at the buffers. All those things have been going on involving wide stakeholder groups, and literally they're going on today. So there's a variety of things, I think, people can come in and present. But I would encourage council members to go to some of those meetings. That meeting is still going on. It's a few blocks away. And those are public meetings as well, where recommendations have to be made to the legislature about taxation policy. Finally, we also said that across all the environmental laws and ag laws relating to green acres and property taxation, if people break the law, then they're not eligible for the benefit anymore. And that was something we did this session. So property, special tax benefits are not a right, but a privilege. So if you break the law, you drain the wetland, or you plow up your buffer, you can lose that tax benefit. So these are all pieces that I think very few people are aware of that we've done and are continuing to do. So it's not just throwing money on what's required already. There's very little that's required.
Thank you. Are there any other questions of members, by members like Mr. Mueller? Thank you. This was very, very helpful. Members, I'd like to just adjust the agenda a bit. I'd like to move item number 7 down to right before number 10, because I think it's a good talking about this issue of
fee acquisition underneath permanent conservation easement will fit into, could fit into the discussion or segue into the discussion of our project proposal ranking. So what I'd like to do now is Susan here?
LCC. Hi, Susan. Yes.
If you could, we'd like to hear an update on the Environmental Trust Fund recommendations. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. For the record, my name is Susan Thornton. I'm the director of the LCCMR. And this, thank you for inviting me in today to talk to you on behalf of the commission related to the LCCMR's 2010 recommendations to the 2010 legislature, which we just adopted a few weeks ago. This is a continuing effort, coordination between the council and the commission. Mr. Becker came before the commission a number of weeks ago before we started our hearings process to inform us about your planning process and inform us about what was going to be in your request for proposal related to the proposals that you are under review today. So we would like to continue this dialogue and back and forth and whatever opportunities that we can see for council and commission members to review things jointly, reviewing the funds as we move forward together. So thank you. In your packets, it's blue and green sheets, and I know you were looking for some more paper in addition to what you have with you today. The first three pages are out of our request for proposal, which was issued last February of 2009. Those proposals were due to us May 1 of 2009. The priorities, as you can see in the material before you, related to water resources and groundwater sustainability, emerging contaminants in surface and groundwater, innovative ways for aquatic habitat protection. Second category related to renewable energy and climate change and community-based energy initiatives. Category C was habitat restoration, enhancement, and acquisition, including looking at training and guidelines for enhanced restoration in Minnesota's major ecotypes. That was a specific initiative of the commission to seek proposals in that. And continuing with specific acquisition efforts, particularly focused on looking at multiple benefits for conservation. Item D was invasive species, not normal maintenance and control, but what are some initiatives related to invasive species. E was natural resource conservation planning and implementation. Again, what are some different alternative aspects that we can be doing, provide funding for, to assist communities, to assist organizations in different venues for conservation. And F was environmental education, in particular looking at understanding climate change, involving outdoor classroom settings as a venue for providing environmental education to both students and adults. And then we had a creative ideas category, which was think outside the box a little bit, and if we would be open to some things that possibly the commission was not considering, new emerging issues and so forth coming before the commission. So that's where we started out on that adopted RFP based on our strategic plan from last January and February. And starting with the green sheet, these are our spreadsheets of our recommendations. In response to the RFP, we received 240 proposals, approximately $164 million, for the $26 million that is available next year from the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund. So for the biennium, there's approximately $52 million available from the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund And a reminder, those dollars are available. As stated in the constitutional language, 5.5% of the market value of the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund. And that value is based on the even year before the biennium. So that value is based on there being $465 million available in the trust fund as of June 30th, 2008. Not June 29th, not July 1st, very specific to that June 30th. So we're kind of a little nervous sometimes when we're looking at what the market is the day before or the day after. The commission is recommending 48 projects. We had hearings on approximately 85 proposals, including the commission had an initiative as we were reviewing the proposal we received, wanting to know what other are the holes in the research related to the emerging issue of the impact from Emerald Ash Borer. So we worked with the forestry community and University Forest Resources Council and developed, in this case, an initiative where we went out and sought a proposal from them with their best collective judgment on some research needs related to Emerald Ash Borer. So as you can see on the green sheet, water resources, 11 appropriations, approximately $5.7 million. Renewable energy, approximately 3.3. Habitat and restoration enhancement, approximately 10 million, about 40% of the dollars that are available. Invasive species, 1.5 million. Conservation planning, close to a million. Environmental ed, approximately 2.6 million. And our creative ideas, about $1.7 million. What I have, the spreadsheets before you, I'm happy to address any types of projects and water resources. Again, our accelerated county geologic atlas, looking at a number of emerging contaminants, updating the wetlands inventory, project related to how are we managing our shallow lakes and the impacts there, vulnerability of trout streams to climate change and impacts on aquatic insects, climate change on our cold water streams, renewable energy, looking at sustainable biofuels and that impact in natural resource planning, environmental. And then if you go to the blue sheets, I pulled out some project summaries from a number of these proposals, trying to think about some things that you might be interested in knowing the commission is funding. As you move forward and review your proposals, I tried to be judicious in how in what I pulled out. I think all the projects are interesting, so I may have actually erred one way or other on what we have before you. But as I said, starting on page one here, this is our second biennium or second appropriation for updating the Minnesota wetlands inventory. As I already mentioned, sustainable cost-effective approaches to managing our shallow lakes. The commission felt knowing the large investments that the trust fund has made in our shallow lakes, restoration and enhancement, and the large investment that the council recommended last year and possibly into the future, this was a proposal from DNR saying, let's take a look at things here, folks. Keep moving forward, we're doing a good job, but maybe we can do a better job. Cumulative impacts to nearshore in-water habitat. What are the developments doing to, and this also is related to shoreline rules. So really taking a look at that. This was one of the recommendations also in the Statewide Conservation and Preservation Plan. Was this be reviewed? I already mentioned the vulnerability of trout streams and climate change. On page three, this is a project, the Mableton Area Ag Urban Runoff Water Quality Treatment Analysis. Again, kind of picking up on your discussion earlier, the goal here is what are some different new innovative ways to keep the water on the land, and also this has a strong evaluation. So if we could have this as a model, it might, and it's not, this type of project, my understanding, talking to the Bowser staff, would not be eligible under the current clean water, or under their, not under the Clean Water Act, but under their current grant programs. So this might help read where those grant programs may go in the future if this is a successful project. I mentioned that biofuels impact climate change. On page 4, again, is Ecological Resource Training Cooperative. This is the one I mentioned a minute ago. This has MnDOT on it. It has Bowser. It's being led by the University of Minnesota. It has DNR. I'm missing some people, but it's a very good, strong team of resource restoration professionals that will be working on this cooperative. Again, knowing that there will be appropriations. The good news is larger appropriations into the future to really get at our restoration needs. And the thought is, as we get more people out there doing these restoration initiatives, to try and provide more of a consistent training for those restoration professionals. So this was an initiative not only by the commission, but it was at the behest of the restoration professional community. We are providing the trust funds, providing some funding for SNA, Native Prairie Restoration Enhancement and Acquisition. This is at $1.7 million. This was a proposal for $8 million. Again, I think this was an area where members felt possibly the trust fund put some dollars into these types of programs where possibly the Outdoor Heritage Fund would be funding. You had it as SNAs in your your request for funding, excuse me. And that maybe the trust fund could fill the niches on some of the sensitive areas and lines. Page 5 to the Nature Conservancy, which is evaluating how we can connect some of these fragmented prairie landscapes on a large scale. Protection of granite rock outcroppings. This is a third of recommended appropriation for this unique resource along the Minnesota River. They have a very thorough ranking system that they presented to us, and I would call it from high to highest of protection of these unique natural resources through conservation easements. And then a follow-up to a shoreline protection project that the commission had funded and is currently funding to DNR related to, again, conservation of unique shorelands. And this is Cass County, but the surrounding counties also within Cass County. Habitat Conservation Partners had $1.4 million. Again, it was an $8 million request. I think the members felt that, well, we were trying to get both corridor projects on every other year cycle. Both corridor projects did come in for another annual proposal, and members felt that this was more, they would provide sort of a supplement to last year's recommended appropriation. Again, trying not to have things on an every year funding cycle, both for the benefit of the commission's work and the benefit of the proposer, so everybody's not just churning out proposals. I think that's something in the future that council staff, commission staff, and council members and staff related to that, you know, we want to be able to work together on coordination, on timing of when the requests for funding go out, and to best serve your time and the public as they're responding to our initiatives. Also on here, I'll just skip ahead briefly to page 11. Mr. Becker also asked me to bring before you a couple of things that are ongoing that we believe will help provide for better natural resource management in the future, provide information both to the commission, to the council, the legislature, and the agencies to do our work better. We are continuing and will complete the restorable wetlands inventory from the appropriation from last year. Again, highlighting the Habitat Corridor partnership and the Metro partnership, that those have been some ongoing projects. On page 12, subdivision 4G, the statewide ecological ranking of conservation reserve programs and other critical lands. This is a project that actually received an additional $63,000. The commission started this through its emerging issues account because the high concern of lands coming out of CRP. And can we get a handle on this soon? This is actually an update on this. It's going to be presented to the LCCMR at our meeting on November 18th in the afternoon. And be available on audio, but also I would encourage you, if you're available, to sit in on that overview and or have them come back to you for an overview at one of your future meetings. The Minnesota Farm Bill Assistance Program, again, wanting to get these conservation programs out there, provide accelerated assistance. The habitat research on deep water lakes regarding the water quality and habitat dynamics, looking at tile drainage evaluation, and really what are the effects of climate change and tile drainage on river erosion being done by the St. Croix Watershed Research Station. Accelerated prairie management and biofuel production, wildlife conservation. And this is one being done looking at what are some different harvesting techniques so that we can look at different scenarios and make sure that as we're going towards biofuels and using our prairies, that we're not just as we call it, vacuuming off the prairies for these biofuels and coming up with some recommendations so that we enhance habitat as we move forward on the biofuels program. And then on 2007, page 14, land retirement effects on Minnesota River basins and streams, done by Bowser and the USGS. Looking at conservation grasslands, water quality, again, being done by the St. Croix Watershed Research Station, and again, done by the prairie biofuels. I went through these very quickly, future, past, and present. Try and what your appetite is the right word for it, but to inform you. And all of these proposals are posted on the website. All the final reports are posted on the website also, as I know yours have been and will be in the future. And we just have received, we've got final reports, about 50 of them that we're reviewing right now, the projects that just ended last summer. I talk fast, but I'm respectful of your time.
Thank you very much, Ms. Gordon. This is really helpful. Members, questions? I have a couple, but I want to refer to other members who might have questions about past, present, or future LCCMR projects. Let me start out then. I don't see any hands going up. I remember seeing in our proposals we received of our 48 a couple that mentioned LCCMR appropriations. Were there any that were, I don't want to say contingent because I don't think that was the case. I read that. But where there was discussion amongst commission members about a potential match with Outdoor Heritage Fund dollars. Can you recall in that discussion as you went through that recommendation process, particular projects that commission members felt strongly there might be a potential for a match or leverage with other funds, particularly Outdoor Heritage Fund dollars?
Mr. Chairman and members, there was discussion, and it was more in the light of looking for opportunities and not looking at these things in silos, the funds in silos, if you will. And I was going back to my notes in preparing to come before you, and unfortunately, I don't have specifics in my notes. I'm going to go back, and I will need to go back to the tape to do that, to relay that to you. I think in a couple of cases, but they did not say, oh, we're not going to fund it, the Outdoor Heritage Council should. Members felt if it was appropriate to the trust fund that we should, that they should put some dollars into it as a recommendation. With that said, with limited funds, some good projects got left on the table. And I think you've got a couple of those in before you. and so it wasn't necessarily a matter of it was a matter of dollars available. The 85 projects we heard totaled about $83 million. I mentioned the SNA project as one where members said maybe the niche for the trust fund is the more sensitive lands related to the SNAs. I know there's a couple, and I'm not coming up with them, but if you bear with me, I will get back to you.
Great, thank you. I guess the other question I have is, you know, we've been asked this a lot, and I guess I would ask you, and the question that we get, and I would ask you is, what opportunities or specific linkages do you see between the work that this council does and your commission does to work together better? We've been asked this with regards to the Clean Water Council as it relates to the Clean Water Fund. What about with the Legislative Citizen Commission and the Environmental Trust Fund? Do you have any specific ideas, notions, recommendations that we might pursue as we move forward? Because, I mean, obviously we don't have any silver bullets to answer that question, but maybe you guys do.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for being so generous, thinking we've come up with that silver bullet. We too have been asked that question, and communication and coordination, I think, is essential. Not only just for your staff's time, our staff time, but the people proposing for the funding, to have it be clear as to what is being asked for. I think, you know, we had one joint meeting. Not that any of us are looking for more meetings, but I think our members have expressed an interest in trying to continue that dialogue. I think that's important. I also mentioned, I think we need to seriously consider and look at when the request for funding or request for proposals, how those cycles can be better coordinated. And I'm sympathetic to your cycle as you get started, because when we went from biennial to annual, it took us like 4 cycles to get on a regular time frame for the funding cycle. So I know some of those struggles to be ready and ready for introduction into the legislative session. So I think, you know, and we probably ought to have a discussion of you know, back and forth, exactly what you asked. Are there some things that we almost propose to each other as challenge matches, shall I say? And are there some things that you as members, information, baseline data, some research that you feel would be helpful in your work and the work of people proposing to you as you move forward? I answered you pretty general. I think there's a lot of coordination work to be done, and I think the council staff and the commission staff are up to the challenge.
Thank you. No, those are good ideas. Bill?
I appreciate the strategic nature of most of the comments you just came up with. I think that we need to be thinking that way. Just as an example of one of the places where there might be some synergy or symbiosis is, you mentioned the statewide ecological ranking of conservation reserve program and other critical lands. And my understanding is that looks specifically at lands that are coming out of CRP, can identify the lands coming out of CRP.
Mr. Chair, members, Bill. And other critical lands is the element. So, yes, it is looking at those lands. It's being jointly done by Bowser and the University of Minnesota, looking at those lands. Now, with that said, I think because of the new, my understanding is because of the new federal farm bill, we're going to be hard-pressed to be able to map those lands. So there are some other challenges.
To the degree that this informs us of what the critical lands are, we're funding programs that have various ranking systems, and it's possible to use the output of this particular project to inform some of the programs that we're funding if we so choose. So I think that's a tactical way to go about coordinating.
Jim?
Yeah, Susan,
because the LCMR has done so many studies or spent a lot of time and effort on studies, do you have an inventory of these studies that we might look at that might be beneficial to the council as we move forward and make decisions?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Press members, not specific. Yes, we have back to 1963, but also back to 1991, which was the first year of the trust fund. All of those, we have abstracts up on our website. We are looking at reorganizing those abstracts on those reports so that they are more issue-based. That will, we hope, will be part of, because we are also part of the new website for constitutionally dedicated funds. So we hope to look backwards in time and reorganize some of those findings that we have to make them more readily available. With that said, if you have some specific questions that you or the staff have, Bill's pretty familiar with a lot of our past projects, we'd be happy to kind of do a mini analysis on some different topics for you.
Other questions?
Just on that point, perhaps what we should do is, as we're aiming toward May, June, July, in the next go-around, think about the specific investments you've made in knowledge that bear on the restore, protect, and enhance mission of the Outdoor Heritage Fund, and come up with for the council's executive committee a list of potential presentations that might inform the council as to these various areas. Does that sound like a reasonable thing to do?
Mr. Chair and Bill and members, and I'll take it a step further. Thank you. That, I think, would be some opportunities for council and commission joint endeavors. Those updates. You know, I have new members also who aren't aware of many of the past projects and past findings that have come about. So I think we can work jointly on that and have that opportunity. What would be a reason for us to get together and have some discussions? It would be that, and then maybe from there we would have some joint recommended outcomes from that as to who moves forward in which direction. And then I'd also like to say that we also have a very long history of restore, protect, and enhance that I'm very proud of on our restoration and acquisition activities.
Any other questions? Seeing you. Thank you very much for this update. It was very helpful.
Thank you, and look forward to working with you.
Likewise. Members, we're going to move on now to agenda number 9. Which is the update on the Small Grants Conservation Partners Program. Ken Hill from the DNR is here. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning, Denise.
I think you all heard we had a grand total of 129 applications that came in for the Conservation Partners Legacy Grant Program. We're pretty happy with that number for a total of $16.6 million. And what I'm passing around now is a handout that kind of summarizes how those broke out by a couple of categories. I didn't hand out earlier because of the data privacy needs. I wasn't sure if I could. And when we checked through it earlier this week, we determined that we could hand this out to you to get some basic summaries. We can't tie it to individual grants, but there's some additional information there. So we're pleased to see that, you know, by the number of applications we got, we can tell that the word got out about the program and that there's a lot of desire for this kind of money and work, too. The public relations we did work, the meetings we held seemed to work, our field staff contact worked. Our field staff was just awesome with doing a good job of getting things out to people, both the clubs they knew and the folks they didn't know. And also the application system. A lot of people were really worried about having an online application, and that didn't seem to be a hurdle. We had a few glitches at the end, and a lot of it was just learning how to work through the system. Mostly things like making sure your documents were closed before you uploaded them. So it wasn't necessarily a system thing. It was just how you work it. So that was good. People, you know, obviously got applications in, and things went very smoothly that way. We had a lot of help internally from the DNR staff. Everybody was very supportive. They all want to see this program succeed, not just the Conservation Partners Grant Program, but everything the council is doing. And good help from our MIS staff and other folks, too. And we learned that was a lot of work to do in a very short time to get this thing up and running. So, I don't know if you want me to walk through the summary sheet with you, or you want to take a look at it, see if you have any questions.
When?
That's it.
Just a question. Could you, overall, looking, there was a lot of applications here. Did you get a chance to review them, go through the basic review, and what were the quality of them?
You know, honestly, we're still going through them. Right now, Jane's back at the office trying to sort through and put things together for our eventual reviewers, make sure we have all the important paperwork there as much as required, and just make sure they fit the grant program. So that's our first step, and it's 129, we haven't gotten it yet.
One other question, because we're going to be looking at very shortly at the appropriations for next year, and as we've got a value stuck in there, and I see that this almost is four times higher than what we are projecting for the next year, if there's some way to expedite the process so we could, if you were to come back and say, every one of them was knock your socks off, great. And if we're going to be turning back, we have currently $12 million for the project. That would be key to finding out whether we are providing enough money for that project.
We should have some better information by that point. My problem is going to be that until we actually select all the applications, it won't be until the middle of December. I do have some limits as to what information I can give out, because a good chunk of that is non-public information. Hopefully I can give you kind of a gut feeling on that, but I'm not sure how much I can give you. So, you know, we're hoping to fund the cream of the crop project. We know we've only got $2.7 million to work with, and we want to fund the best ones that we can. So that's
all.
Bill,
just on that point there.
Okay, yeah.
So what I guess I'm looking at is generalities. If you were to come back and say, well, guess what, there was 12 out of the 16 million that was requested, 12 million for debt on something we consider high priority, that would give us a clue as to whether we are funding that particular small grant program properly.
Sure, that makes sense.
Bill.
My understanding of the schedule here is that the department will have completed their evaluation and awarding, so to speak, prior to our markup. So if that is the case, we can get some information before we allocate, do a final allocation of funds.
Thank you, that is correct.
Remember questions? You've got a nice set of breakouts here of proposals. Did you have any by the sections, the council sections? Did you have a rough sense of where the distribution of these proposals are across Minnesota?
I could have done it by county, but I don't think your actual sections came out until your fiscal 11 request for proposal. And I'm kind of working under the 10 still. And I could be wrong on that. But no, it's not a question that we had in our database. And this is all based on a database that folks entered in on our application system. And I don't think we'd ask that question at all.
I think there's one thing that the council ought to just be thinking about. And that is, in one case, I know of a particular proposal that went to the DNR program and also came to us this time. And there's the potential for that to happen. The data privacy laws today prohibit DNR from looking at our applications and informing us of any duplication. We may want to consider whether or not a very limited notwithstanding of those laws might be useful in the interest of good expenditure of public money and transparency. The data privacy laws are sacrosanct as far as I'm concerned, and I really hate to do anything that might appear to be weakening them, but if we can clearly see that it's important to know, then I think it might be a useful thing to do, limited to this appropriation recommendation only.
Couple questions. Oh, Scott, please.
So, Bill, in more general terms, what do we got to do that? I mean, what is required? What would be required for them to be able to say, yeah, we got a duplicate application here? Or to make some of this data not quite so super critical that the council or the small grants can share that data back and forth?
Yes.
In order to enable us to share the information, let me just back up. I talked to Kristen Batson at MMB Grants Management about this. I haven't talked to council about it at all, so I'm on a little bit of thin ice. But I think what we need to do is, in the actual recommendation for this appropriation in the future, provide the capacity for limited sharing of information, such as the nature of projects that are in common. That's the extent of it. And that would allow DNR staff to come before us in a meeting like this and say, we've looked at the projects that have been submitted to you. Here are the ones that were also submitted to us.
What I've handed out is a copy of the legislation. If you look at subdivision 3, responses to request for proposals, once the responses are open, the name and address of the grantee and amount requested is public, and everything else is private or non-public until we finish reviewing everything. So that's what we're working through, the DNR data privacy staff, to determine what we can release and what we can't.
I'm sorry. Bob.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is it possible, or can't we, just simply as we're interviewing the project, simply as part of that interview process, saying, have you applied for funding from other sources?
You read Jim's mind. You just made the very same comment 15 seconds ago.
I knew we had a lot in common, yeah.
Absolutely. I think that's a great idea. I think we need to make sure we ask that question of any applicant that we meet. Could you, Ms. Tannehill, could you explain a little bit more about the review and selection process? Who's going to do that? You or Bill had mentioned that the decisions will be made prior to our recommendations. Can you give us a little sense of how that's going to unfold within the department?
Sure. Denise has been working on setting it up lately, so if you don't mind, I'll turn that
sure.
over. And we're still in the process of formalizing the process, and we have a meeting set with the commissioner tomorrow to review it with him. But what we said in our accomplishment plan was that we would have a technical advisory committee made up of no more than 9 people, internal DNR and external DNR. And so we are going to still follow that program, that what's in the accomplishment plan. But what we're thinking about doing is to ease the review of the applications, is to break those down by subgroups. So we have a wetlands group, a forestry group, an acquisitions group, and they would review the applications that came in those areas, do some preliminary reviews and ranking, and then this technical advisory group would take the subgroups and make their recommendations then up through to the commissioner.
So do you have criteria that you can then judge each proposal against, or is that to be developed? Or, I mean, when you give this pile of proposals to the group, how are you going to ask them to evaluate them? On what merit?
The criteria is actually laid out in Chapter 172, and we've incorporated that into all of our grant documentation. There's actually 20 of them that we'll use to form right in Chapter 1.
And that was included in the IRP.
And so do you anticipate, of the $4 million roughly in available funds, all of that being allocated this first round, or do you plan to hold a second call later this year?
We're interested in hearing your thoughts on that, on what you guys would like to see happen, what the council would like to see happen.
Scott?
One of the questions I have is we get, obviously, we get proposals that far exceed our ability to fund them all and fund all the good ones. Are you going to, would you make a recommendation to fund a proposal that's on this, on your list? Are you, I'm assuming that you're going to fund the whole proposal. I mean, we oftentimes, somebody applies for $5 million, they get $1.5 million, okay? They can continue to go forward on that work. Is it your intention to fund a proposal all or nothing, or are you going to take some of those $400,000 proposals if you deem they have value and say, this is a good proposal, but we're not going to give them $400,000, we're going to give $150,000? What is your protocol there?
I think we're still figuring that out because we don't know what we have yet. But I can tell you, having written grants, that's money you only get half of it funded, is problematic. Sometimes it's cut to the point where you really can't do it. But we also, you know, we have the ability to go through and say, this part of your application really doesn't fit the program. So we can winnow some of those things out if they're not appropriate. However, at this point, it'd be nice to fund everything because then you possibly get into the problem of applicants ask for twice what they really need just to make sure they get what they think. You know, we don't want to get into that situation where people over ask just to make sure they get what they feel like they have. That's a concern we're still working out. And again, our goal is to fund and run the best program possible. And if that means starting out small with only our $3.7 million this year until next appropriation, we need some time to build the program up and get it up and running properly and to do it well rather than just to do quantity.
I think if I got this right, the question sort of was whether we should have a second round of applicants. And I'm thinking in terms of that if these are good projects, why not do it all at one time and get it done? There's people that I know are waiting on projects, and of course, depending on when, if the quicker you can get them approved, the quicker they can start putting the gears in motion and wheels in motion and make sure that they're ready to get going by next spring. And I would be a little hesitant to hold back just because we're not sure if they're the best. I think that the original intent of this was that if after the first round there's only $3 million for the project, that we have a second round. I don't think it was intended to delay it because the projects may not be good enough.
I'm hoping with $16 million in requests that we'll have $3.7 million in really good projects.
Scott? Well, then on the flip side of that, the reason that the council might actually consider holding back $1 million or something of this and having another round of funding. And my initial thought process has obviously showed out in the numbers. I mean, we had 120-some projects, 75 of those are local units of government who are obviously far more eloquent in their abilities to manufacture grant applications. You know, I went through there, I did just a preliminary little number there. If you take out government applications and some of what I would call the well-established conservation groups, there's about 40 applications from that group that we are really hoping to include in the Conservation Partners Program, which are small conservation clubs and different organizations that may not have been involved in this process before. So I agree with Wayne on his point that if you have great projects, you can fund them. But if we did decide to fund, you know, all but $1 million, have another round giving some of those other organizations an opportunity to apply, that might have merit as well.
I think that just because they submit an application doesn't mean it's a good application. I think we need to look and see what we've got for those applications before we make the determination that the government ones are the best ones as opposed to the nonprofits. I hear what you're saying, but we need to look at that. And also a lot of those were soil and water districts who are working on some easements and other things. It's still local habitat work being done locally. Maybe it's not through a nonprofit, but your soil and water districts are pretty local folks. It's not like coming directly from the state or the feds or something else and go off and do this. So, yeah, it's something we need to look at. I can't answer any more about the quality applications in front of you.
Steve?
I'm just trying to understand, I guess, your response that your intention or desire would be to fund whatever people ask for in full. I've done a lot of grants, and I can't imagine taking that. We need to look at the proposal and what they're trying to accomplish and question whether or not the proposal needs all of the money and balance all of the money you have against all of the proposals. I think that you're just blindly going to say, if they ask for $200,000, if it looks okay, we're going to give them $200,000. It's ludicrous.
I'm sorry, it's ludicrous. I can't imagine it. And frankly, if that's your attitude and you guys come back for money, somebody else ought to run this program as far as I'm concerned. I'm sorry.
Again, it's really hard to say until we see the applications. Why should we cut down a good application just because they asked for $200,000? We just got to look at them. We just don't know enough at this point to really answer those questions.
Other questions? Thank you very much. Members, good morning, Senator. We've been moving the agenda around a bit. We are now on agenda item number 7, which is discussion of deed title underneath permanent use of film. You want to clean this one up?
And for the Senator, we've already got 89. So let me give you a little background on this particular item. The Council has reviewed one accomplishment plan, the Green Corridors Plan, developed by fee title underneath land with permanent conservation easements. And the Council withheld approval of that accomplishment plan in part because the acquisition provided no additional protection to the habitat protected by the permanent conservation easements. After the program manager substituted acquisition targets with no associated permanent conservation easements, the Council approved the plan. Subsequently, the fiscal year 2011 draft call for proposals distributed to the Council on September 15th proposed that the call exclude requests to purchase land with permanent conservation easements. The call prohibited this through minimum criteria 21, which read, propose acquiring in fee land only without other permanent protection. This minimum criterion was inadvertently deleted from the draft call for requests on the evening of September 15th, 2009, and was never even considered by the Council. So the issue that's before us in item number 7 is that the denial of the first request to buy fee title to land protected by a conservation easement, along with the publication of the September 15th draft call restricting acquiring land with other permanent protection and the restriction's overnight disappearance, has created uncertainty among recipients of fiscal year 2010 appropriations and uncertainty among individuals involved in the fiscal year 11 recommendations. Therefore, it's useful to set the impact of the Council's actions in inadvertent deletion of Criterion 21 on the existing, set forth the impact of the Council's actions in inadvertent deletion of Criterion 21 on the existing appropriations and the upcoming recommendations as follows. For existing appropriations, the Council will consider proposals to acquire fee title to land protected by permanent conservation easement on a case-by-case basis as amendments to approved accomplishment plans. The amendment should demonstrate that the fee title acquisition adds protection or is necessary for restoration or enhancement. For upcoming recommendations, because the approved call did not contain minimum criteria prohibiting recommending purchase of fee title to lands protected by a permanent conservation easement, the Council may consider recommending requests containing references to purchases of fee underneath easements. In summary, the Council will judge all requests containing easement acquisition on a level playing field with those that do not. What I've just read to you is a statement that was agreed to by one individual who raised the issue and leadership of the Executive Committee to just set the groundwork for what we're doing in terms of discussing proposals as we go forward, specifically with regard to the issue of purchasing the fee underlying a permanent conservation easement. And with that, I would move on to the discussion.
Thank you, Bill. In just reviewing the 40 proposals, I counted 5 proposals where under question 15, which was, Do you propose to acquire land in fee where there is a permanent conservation easement? So 5 proposals said maybe, that might be the case. So I think the Council, I mean, my personal feeling as chair and just as a member of this Council is that unless it can be documented that additional protection is afforded by acquiring that remaining bundle of rights that have not been relinquished by the landowner, it would need to use
funds other than the Outdoor Heritage Fund. However, I've been informed of some specific examples where you would have to acquire the fee to that land in order to do the protection, the restoration, or the enhancement work. So anyway, to me, I go back to what the constitutional use of the fund is, and unless it can be clearly demonstrated that acquisition or enhancement or restoration work will actually protect, enhance, or restore further, then to me, the Outdoor Heritage Fund is not available. But I'd like to hear other council members' comments on that, and particularly council as well. We've been talking about this issue for some time. If you have any take on it as well. But other members, Scott?
And I remember the proposal that came forth to us last year. You know, when you take a look at a 320-acre parcel, which is already completely protected by a permanent conservation easement, for us to acquire the fee title under that would be, in almost all aspects, at least from my opinion, questionable. You know, the issue that I see is you have a 300-acre acquisition protection that has 34 acres of permanent buffer strip in it, okay? That's in a rim easement or a crep easement that already exists. Obviously, acquiring the balance of that property at, you know, the other 290 acres has great value, but the seller says the only way you're going to get the 290 you want is to acquire the fee title under this 30 acres that's already under a permanent conservation easement. And to me, as long as the value of that is calculated appropriately, I think that for us to absorb a small portion of an overall project, you know, I think Kenan does have merit. You know, the one that you speak of initially obviously did not. You know, this one might very well be able to do that. And so I would like the council to at least have the opportunity to consider those projects, you know, if they in fact meet what would be my secondary option of not the vast majority of the property, a small section or sliver, you know, at an appropriate figure.
Other members? Yeah, Wayne?
I personally believe that if we really diminish our overall objectives, I think if we restrict fee title purchases on permanent easements. I can think of a number of things. I'll give an example. 100 acres that is presently in private ownership. 30 acres is in the WRP contract, which may be have the best use there is to do a wetland restoration. That's in addition to what's already there. A lot of the easements that are out there right now were established with minimum standards to establish some kind of conservation practice on it. There might be many more things we can do to it. And by doing the purchase, you might be able to take that same piece of property and turn it into a WMA. It appears that the individual would have to gift it to us, the 30 acres, for instance, in a 100-acre tract, 30 acres is under permanent easement, the other 70 isn't. We could buy the 70, but you would have to gift this to 30 in order for us to do maximum enhancements on the thing. And done not just that one, but I see a number of other issues that are out there why we would not want to restrict it. So it doesn't mean we have to go out and wholesale buy these. But I don't think we want to restrict ourselves with language which down the road might prevent us from purchasing something which we really want to have.
And when there's another way of dealing with that example you gave, which is not to ask the landowner necessarily to gift it, but to use other funds than the Outdoor Heritage Fund for that part of the purchase. And given almost all of the rights, except probably the right to pay the property tax or that responsibility to pay the property tax, are left with the landowner, that residual value should be pretty small. And recall, our proposals we received this last go-around, not the ones we're looking at, were very highly leveraged, over 50 cents on the dollar. So my guess is we're talking about a small amount of money for a small fraction of an acquisition. And I guess in that case, it isn't necessarily restricted to a donation, but use some other funds.
But I also say that we might have situations going out and purchasing land, use a WMA, get Purchasing land is $2,000 an acre. And the person that has the easement sitting there right now, why would he not want to even get $2,000? That's pretty cheap for us to be able to turn around and create, to be able to convert something which is private use to public use. Granted, there was some money done before which protected it and we've got a conservation easement, but buying the opportunity for the public to be able to use something has also got a great value. We've seen that by the number of land we go around and buy WMAs, or buy land and be titled for WMAs, and the easements we've spent money on, and will continue to spend money on. They're very expensive. And any time that we can turn around and take something which is in private ownership and put it into public use, I think has some great value.
Eleanor.
Well, Mr. Chair, I basically agree with you. But I think besides the constitutional requirement that you're talking about, I think it's, you know, it's a basic matter of being fiscally responsible. And, you know, if we're going to be responsible for the dollars that we have, which are always limited, we're not using our money wisely if we spend money buying land that's already protected by law. It just should be the lowest priority. Because the alternative would be to buy land that isn't protected at all. And that's where I think we'll have bigger impact on public access or other protecting the land if it's not already protected. But, I mean, I can certainly see that there are some circumstances that are a gray area, and I appreciate what both of you have said about that, and maybe we want to allow that possibility to be discussed. But I think the general rule should be very, very clear that that's not where we should spend our dollars unless there's a really, really good reason not to. We've had a great deal of discussion about having conservation easements that actually require stewardship of the land. And that's part of what we're paying for. And yeah, some of them were put in place a long time ago. Excuse me. And there hasn't been very good stewardship. But to me, it means then we should look at who's the holder of the easement, whether it's the state or a private entity, and why aren't they enforcing the requirements that that landowner agreed to? That's where we should be focusing our efforts. Excuse me. And I guess it just reinforces the idea that if we're going to put any money into easements, we better make darn sure that this is not an issue that ever arises in the future.
Well, I'd agree with you, but I carry it a step further, which is that one of the things I would love to see us come out at the end of 25 years with is to build a culture of philanthropy in terms of environmental practices, and that's about, to me, creating opportunities for organizations to leverage our money by finding other resources, local resources, and build more of a culture than we've had in the past and not depend entirely on state money. And so in addition to thinking that we shouldn't spend our money on things that are already protected, I think there's an opportunity to leverage our money on projects and let that other piece that might do something beyond what we're willing to do play in that field instead of us taking that role.
Okay. And my thoughts are not far from that, okay? They're not. I don't think that this is going to be something that we're going to want to go out and pursue. But if you have a 640-acre wetland acquisition that has no access, you have this primo 1,200-acre wetland restoration you can do, but there's no access, and you could buy some access by buying 20 acres of a piece of property that's in permanent conservation easement, so that we can, you know, you can all, because you can't, obviously I don't think we're not going to do any acquisitions or protections on property that doesn't have access. So if that access is then provided by buying a sliver or a parcel of permanently protected conservation easement in order to get access, those are the kinds of things that I think that I'm talking about. I agree that there is no value in spending, tying up lots of dollars on large blocks of property that are in a conservation easement, but there are times when that can be of value.
Rick, did you have your hand?
Yeah. I need a little clarification on the two scenarios. So we have the existing appropriation that has been voted on and funded, and I know there was, we have the accomplishment plan there. So could you maybe clarify a little bit there that we've approved the accomplishment plan? Has that particular appropriation, with what has happened with this inadvertent, does that mean that we will be, that project can buy the title under the easement or not?
Mr. Chair, for that particular appropriation, no. They would have to come in with an amendment to the current one program, which has no targeted acquisitions with permanent conservation easements, and amend it to so that it had one, and then we would have to discuss that. That's the case-by-case basis.
So the status quo for what we have, what has been appropriated right now is there's no change. The question in front of us is in regard to when we hear projects in the future, because the RFP or the request proposals did not include that, do we cannot judge them based on that criteria. We can judge them on all the other criteria, but we can't judge them on that criteria because that was not included. And the chair said there's probably five of them of whatever that are there. So then our responsibility is to judge fairly without that consideration right now the status quo, without any action being taken by the council.
And I think just to build on that, Rick, I think it's fair game to ask the proposers of the five, I think if there are five, you know, what options do we have? Other outdoor heritage fund dollars, you have a large list of acquisitions where, you know, you could substitute others, whatever. And I think we do need to take them on a case-by-case basis. Wait.
Mr. Chair, Ellen, actually, you know, when I was looking at this, I was thinking about you and your situation here in the metro area. We are spending quite a few dollars on, or trying to, around this on easements, protecting easements along rivers, lakes, whatever. And as the metropolitan area continues to expand, we want to have public use opportunities for some of these areas. What do we do when we have a perfect trout stream finally developed and there's no place to go fishing because all the land is private along it, but we have the opportunity to go out and buy that land along there for public use, and now we've created something that people otherwise don't have access to. And so that was one of my thoughts is, if we keep putting easements and everything, pretty soon we may not have, everybody will retain legal private ownership and we won't have the opportunity to fix up public land. So that was, anyway, that was one of my thoughts. Maybe I'm in the wrong.
Well, Mr. Chair, you're absolutely right, but I think, we're talking about, we're talking about existing easements. And so it's a really different question whether we want to go out and buy easements or land when we're starting from, you know, a clean slate and the land isn't protected at all. Then I think that's a really important question. But, how do we make sure there's public access, especially in places where we don't have it or it's a resource that really deserves it? But when you've already got some protection, it's just a little bit less compelling.
Well, and so, Sir Grant, I'm not looking at wholesale purchasing of these things either. I think that there are opportunities will arise when we're one on one to look at it, and I hate to see us bind our hands by not by restricting these fully.
Any other thoughts? I think it's important that we have this discussion as we go forward and review these proposals. Keep those questions in mind as we see a proposal that has indicated a no to question 15 on the proposal form, which was, you proposed to, or could there be the opportunity to acquire land that has an underlying permanent conservation easement on it? The answer was no. I can't remember how you phrased it, but there were five or more than that. Any other comments or questions? Okay. Members, the last item that we have on our agenda, we broke it up a bit before lunch and a bit after lunch, but what we need to do now is we need to talk about and ultimately agree on a set of the proposals, a subset of proposals that we would like to hear more information about through subsequent hearings either at the end of this month or into December. And so I guess to tee this part of the conversation off, Sandy, did you have a few things you wanted to provide as context and background to council members?
Thinking about the proposals and members' ranking them,
you each answered three questions. The first one being that, in your opinion, does this project meet all of the minimum criteria, in which members answered yes or no? Then members who answered yes to that question moved on and rated each project from 1 to 5 based on statewide priority and regional priority, 5 being fully met the priority and 1 doesn't address the priority. Those members' tallies were totaled up for each project and divided by the number of members who voted or answered yes to question 1 for those projects. The list that's before you is in rank order from highest to lowest as far as where the votes came out, the ranking came out.
So in your packet you have a sheet printed on 2 sides, 8.5 by 11. It has the scores of all 40 projects in rank order.
So what Bill and I did, just to carry on from what Sandy described, is we looked at the rankings. So the average score for 2 and 3, which you have on this single-page, two-sided handout, and they're listed in rank order. And we were trying to look for a logical breakpoint. And the logical breakpoint that that Bill and I saw, anyway, was the first page.
That was a 0.18 break, and it was the largest one in that particular middle area.
So I guess before we get a motion on the table to talk about a set of proposals we're going to hear, I'd just like to open the floor to see if council members have any general comments, thoughts, feedback about what they saw in the proposals, and then after that I'd like to get into taking a motion, to have a motion on the floor to get a discussion going about what set of proposals, what subset of the full set of proposals we'd like to hear. So any random thoughts about what was in this package? Rick?
Yeah, my question about project number 1, remember what exactly they agreed to last year, because it wasn't in legislation, but I thought there was a commitment for on page 2. Yeah, so I just want to discuss that, because I'm trying to remember
Members, this is the Anoka County. It's the 550-acre land acquisition along the Rum River and Cedar Creek in Anoka County. And Bill and I, in fact, had quite a conversation about how to deal with that one. And I see Greg going to Chapter 172. Greg, can you read what that appropriation language said for that first $1.9 million?
Yes, Mr. Chair. It's $1.9 million in fiscal year 2010. For an agreement with Anoka County to acquire land in confluence of Rum River and Cedar Creek in Anoka County. Acquired land must remain open to hunting and fishing consistent with capacity land during the season. And then the last sentence, I think, is what's important here. This is the first of 2 planned appropriations for this acquisition. So there was an indication in the law last year that it would be final funding for this year.
And I didn't sense any sentiment from individual council members, certainly not collectively, that we wouldn't follow through on that. Bill and I thought it would be important to put it in there just because we would like to have Anoka County come and make an update to us to tell us where they are in this process. You know, is this acquisition continuing to move forward as planned before we make a decision on that second year appropriation? So right now it's in the mix, and as you can see, at least in what I proposed, it's on the first page, which would be, as the chair, my proposal of what I think would be a subset of the proposals that the council members rank that we should hear over the next couple of meetings. Other thoughts or comments just in general about what you saw? Jim?
I was just wondering if we do as you suggested, Mike, and make this cut at 15, these projects that are not going to be seen, is there any way that we could maybe, if some of the council members feel very strongly about some of these, that, you know, maybe they were misinterpreted by the council in general, or some way that people felt strongly about them, that they could get some kind of a hearing or something, so that we all are on the same page and we're judging these projects on really information that we interpret incorrectly or whatever.
Absolutely. I think that's a really good idea. And we certainly want to give every opportunity for every project. So if there was, I mean, what you see is, you know, what our collective thought as we reviewed their responses to the information requested by the council. But if there was information that was misinterpreted, misleading, whatever, we need to know about it. And so I guess my thought going forward is that, again, hopefully shortly we could entertain a motion to adopt something, and as a starting point would be the projects on the first page just for hearing, not making any guarantees beyond that, but then discuss that, and if certain council members feel strongly that a project that either is on the list really should be there on the first page, or that there's a project on the second page that really should be there for some reasons, we need to hear about that. So, Jim, to your point, when we go to this set of hearings, hopefully over 2 days, we all feel very comfortable about the projects we're going to hear and that no one is grousing that, well, you know, if they only understood the project better, they would have ranked it higher. So this is the time to have that conversation. Scott.
To get the process started, I would make the motion to accept the first page as the subset of proposals that we'll hear at a hearing.
So we have a motion on the floor to accept the 24 proposals that are listed on the first page of the handout, starting at the top with Project 8 and ending with Project 15 as the subset of the 40 that we would hear. Ellen, then we have discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just remind us what you're proposing for the dates and how many hours and how much time for each hearing.
Great question, Ellen. As part of your packet, Bill updated us on, you should find the schedule of hearings. It's a single page, looks like this. And so we have set aside, remember, just recall for our own information, the last cycle of review, we had 99 projects, proposals. And so, you know, Bill said, let's set aside time for 48. About half. Now we have, we received 40, and we're proposing at least at this point in time, 24. I think, and Bill, I think, concurs, I know he concurs, we can do this in 2 days of meeting. So part of this discussion today is we set aside 3 days, and my proposal would be that we do it in 2 days, and I would go even further to say, let's do these back-to-back days. So that we all have the proposal fresh in our minds within a 2 day period of time so that we can even more fairly judge the merits of each of the proposals.
So Mr. Chair, so if we did them those 2 days in December, that would be 30 minutes per project?
I'm going to defer to Bill on that. He did the calculus on what we would be able to allocate.
How long do you want to be?
Yeah, Chair, that's right.
Senator Anderson, we believe that we can do 45 minutes per, if necessary. So, in a 9 to 6 frame, with time out for.
Scott, did you have any further?
So, if we're going to try to do that over 2 days, does that mean that the scheduled meeting we have on 11/23 would be canceled?
Correct. That would be the proposal. Bill?
Might I also say, as coordinating the presentations for LCCMR, the DNR for years, it was our objective to get our presentations as close to the allocation as possible. I'm not sure it makes any difference, but we should have felt it did.
Rick?
I like that we've got a motion on the floor. My question is if we could have some acknowledgement that number one is special.
You're using that term very frequently today. Yes, let's make note in the meeting minutes that proposal number one is the second year of a 2-year appropriation that the council and the legislature committed to, and that we would certainly want to bring them in and get an update, but it's our intent to fund that second year. Other point.
My question does have some bearing on funding we look at and the time it's going to take. Is there a way to streamline the presentations so that they're all answering 10 items that we're all interested in getting? For instance, saying, number one, here's my cost. Two, here's the outcomes. Three, this is what's going on. And we hear the same thing from everybody. Sometimes during the last process, when we start going through them, a lot of rambling goes on. Pretty soon you lose sight of what the project is, the proposal. I would really like to get right down to the meat of it. How important is it and why is it so important?
Yeah. Wayne, I think that's an excellent suggestion. I was thinking the very same thing. But let's say that we have 45 minutes per proposal. I would like Bill to give directions to all the proposers. You have 15 minutes to answer the following five questions. And I would say with that, please send Bill or Sandy suggestions you have about what you ticked off a number of those, Wayne, the most important parts of their proposal. Because, at least for me, when we went through the last round, the value added was in the question and answer. It was not, I've read the proposal, I know what's in there. I want to get at that additional information that's not in writing. So, you know, that would be my recommendation, is that we get very explicit instructions to the proposers. You have 15 minutes, we're going to stop you at that. You need to answer these 5, 6, 8 questions, and then it's going to be question and answer with council.
And then on this last group, I found it, I had a hard time deciphering in there whether it's available for public use or not. Sometimes they answered a question, sometimes it didn't.
Yep.
So we've already kind of gone through and found some very specific questions, I think, from the past around that we're all interested in hearing. And I think if we can restrict that initial 15 minutes to saying this is where we want you to get all those items, it's going to give me a very good idea of what they're looking at.
Bill, if members would send to Sandy list of questions that they'd like to see asked in all proposals by a week from tomorrow, that would be appreciated, and we'll collate them and homogenize them.
And Sandy, can I just ask you to just put a note to send an email to council members just to remind them to do that?
Yeah, Rick. I have a question on one of the projects about the statutory applicability, if it's feasible under existing law as to what it's made, and I'd like to ask, because I think that bears on whether that should be considered, and I'd like to ask Bowser to come to the table if possible, and I'd like to ask him about the room for forest habitat, if that is statutorily doable under existing RIM statutes to provide RIM easements for forest habitat.
Is someone from the Water Water Soil Resource here? Oh, yeah, Ms. Blackburn. Good morning.
Morning, thank you, Chair and members.
Did you hear the question?
Yes. Representative Hansen, could you restate your question, please?
Ms. Blackburn, do you have a copy of that proposal, number 15? And my question is, under the RIM statutes, not appropriations, but RIM statutes, is what is being proposed of having easements for forest habitat as they're proposing it?
This is 15. Proposal 15.
Proposal 15.
So the question is that proposal statutorily permissible?
Yes. Mr. Chair and Commission members, it is. We actually have had conversations and conference calls with the proposers asking about whether or not it works with the RIM program or whether they should be purchasing easements locally through their county or other entity. And the RIM statute provides for an incredibly flexible program. And so it is, with my understanding, the way that they submitted it, it does fit into statutorily permissible activities.
Rick? So having money go from the council to individual districts rather than through Bowser is statutorily possible?
Commission members, Bowser would still be the holder of the easement.
Mr. Chair, I'm not quite sure that's what the proposal said.
Yeah. Yeah, can you elaborate a bit more on that, Rick?
I gave my proposal to Mr. Peterson. But I think it...
Mr. Chair and yeah. Commission members, it wouldn't be a RIM easement unless Bowser held it. It is only the Bowser easement program.
And on that point, members, when I reviewed this proposal, I felt it did meet the minimum criteria for that point, because if you look at page 3 of the proposal, it says the conservation easement program will be established. I read that as saying this is a new acquisition program.
It says the proposal will provide SWCDs in cooperation with Bowser the resources to offer conservation uses. To me, that says it's the district that would be issuing these.
Mr. Chair and Commission members, what it means is that it's providing those SWCDs with the resources to get out there and acquire those easements. But the easements are Bowser easements through the RIM program. That's the way that it was. The way that it was designed, and if that doesn't come through with clarity, we would definitely like the opportunity for the proposers to come back and provide more clarity. But since it is part of the RIM program, it is a Bowser easement. It's not a new program.
Greg, I don't want to put you on the spot if you're not ready, but you, after looking and consulting with the statutes, any thoughts on this issue?
Well, Mr. Chairman and members, there are specific criteria for eligible land within the statutes for the RIM program. It is a long laundry list of items. I mean, it's marginal agricultural land, adjacent to marginal agricultural land, consists of a drained wetland, land that has been breaking for water quality improvement practice, land in a sensitive groundwater area, riparian land and forests that still be considered. Cropland or not cropland, it needs to restore wetlands. Is a woodlot on agricultural land? Is it an abandoned building site on agricultural land? Is land used for pasture? So there are a number of categories of items that do fit under as eligible land. But of course, I mean, this is a statutory guidance that the legislature were to pass a law saying to do it for a certain type of land that may not fit under this. The specific law provides the general law. So the legislature would pass a law saying that they wanted this to happen. It would still override the statute if they wanted to.
And so, members, keep in mind that at this point in the process, we're not making any decision about the merits of the proposal other than that it's on our shorter list to at least investigate further. And what I'm hearing is that, yes, it is allowable, according to your agency's interpretation of what the proposal is saying.
Yes, and Mr. Chair, as well as that, these would be Bowser held, not providing a whole new program for local units of government. They asked us about this because they have some particular individual needs in that area that haven't been so far funded through the typical RIM conservation program, which has been directed more towards the prairie area.
Any further? I don't think that's okay. Other member comments? I guess in particular, I'd like, Jim had a really good suggestion. Are there any proposals that you see listed on the back page that you see the rankings? You know where council members and all other members rank the proposal, by the way. I just want to make sure that we give those proposals, a fair shake. And so if a member feels very strongly that the rest of the members misinterpreted what was being proposed or can make a compelling case otherwise, let's hear that now. Otherwise, I think we need to move on and make a decision about what we're going to hear. Rick?
Well, I was kind of surprised that the Dakota County one, since we funded some of the last time and we visited the site and saw some of our sites in Dakota County. Just wondering, for a lower ranking on that, maybe why, what questions people have or what some of the challenges were with that one.
So I think that's just an open question to members about how you might have viewed. This is proposal number 23. Members, while you're thinking about that, I guess I'd just ask a question. We were scheduled a break for lunch at noon, and the item, we have two items. We have this agenda item and then a public comment, and I don't know, Bill, if we have any public comments. Okay, we don't have any, but we want to make that opportunity. What's your preference? We have 12 minutes to noon now. You want to just kind of go through this and wrap the meeting, the business meeting up, and if that means we go till a bit after noon.
Yes.
That's what I'm sensing, and that's what I would propose. But I want to make sure members
are okay with it. Okay, so we're going to proceed. So getting back to Rick's question, any members have any thoughts about that proposal, particularly someone who might have viewed it ranked fairly low?
Well, just, you know, I think visiting the site and seeing that there's been a local effort to match the money, you know, we've got some ability to extend the money, any money that we put in there, in providing the goals of the Constitution. And we've got some other projects that are a little higher there where there may not be as much of a history of local match. I would ask if we could consider the Dakota, at least bring Dakota County in, to hear the presentation, since we have funded them in the past, and we did look at their projects.
I don't have an objection to that, but I think the fact that we looked at something is not rationale for whether or not we should hear.
I agree.
And I would go further in saying when we go on field trips in the future, we should make really sure that we're not setting ourselves up in terms of expectations, and the people who show us properties should understand that they can't promote what they want.
So, Rick, we have a motion on the floor to review further the first 24 listed on the first page. Do you want to make a motion to amend that motion to include proposal number 23, because I think that's the only way we need to do it. So
I'm going to move to amend by adding 23 to come in to present.
Okay, so we have a motion to amend our list to include proposal number 23. This is the Dakota County proposal. Further discussion on that motion to amend our list.
Was there, excuse me, Mr. Chair, was there any more that wanted to be included so you could do it all one time?
This is the only one I heard.
Okay. There's no,
I think we should do these one at a time and bring kind of decide on the merits of each one as opposed to a list of additional ones. So we'll have an opportunity for other members if there's something else. Any further discussion? Jim, I'm sorry.
Well, I would just maybe make a friendly amendment or maybe a new one. Well, the only one I would consider would be 39, which is right underneath it, and maybe what we should do is just instead of going to 24, if we just went to 26, make the cut up at 26, I think.
Okay. Let's. I guess we have a motion on the floor to include number 23. I'd like to take that one up separately, okay. Jim, and then take that one up. So, Rick?
Maybe just to speak to the amendment, is, you know, we asked if there was any problem or a challenge, and that we didn't hear anything. So I think, you know, it may just be, and we don't have a full vote of people here today either. So maybe there's the, by having the opportunity to answer any questions that could clarify and polish that. So I would ask folks to support the
amendment. Okay. Further discussion on the motion. Hearing none, all those in favor of the motion to include project number 23 in the list of proposals that we are going to hear signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Jim.
Well, I would just like to include number 39. For a couple of reasons. Number one, it's a metro project, which we've got a lot of pressure on. I think it's a good metro project. I'm not quite sure why it ranked as low as it did, but I think people got to look at the full proposal, and it would garner some support, so I'd like to include number 39 also.
Okay, so we have a motion on the floor to add proposal number 39 to the list of proposals that we're going to hear. Further discussion on that motion. Rick?
I think seeing that that has the same exact numerical ranking, 3.25, it would be fair to include that. And I would support that.
Further discussion, comments? Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion is adopted. So we have now 26 proposals that I still believe we will be able to do in 2 days. Wayne?
Mr. Chair, one question is, when we come back for the next meeting, could we please, do you have a copy of what we sent you as far as the rankings? So just happened, I couldn't print one up. I went to print it, and I have no ink. So when Johnson was asking, but you have any questions? But I don't remember how I scored.
Bill,
we will make copies for the next meeting.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I want to remind you that all your individual scores will be on the website Monday. So if you agree to place the individual scores on the website in the strategy.
Each one of us, Mr. Chair, we agree to put each one of our choices.
I didn't realize that. Your entire scoring sheet is going to be posted up.
Really?
Yes.
Everybody's.
Yep.
I didn't remember agreeing to that.
No. Okay, back to the original motion. So we have 26 proposals on the list that we will hear over the course of two meetings, December 8th and December 9th. Are there any? Is there any further discussion on that initial motion? Any further discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor of adopting of including the 26 proposals, the ones listed on the first page, and then Project 23 and 39 as the list of proposals that we will hear on December 8th and 9th, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. So we have our list of proposals that we are going to hear.
And we cancel the meeting.
And we cancel the meeting on the 23rd of November. Members, the last item on our agenda are public comments. Bill, I'll just turn that over to you.
Is there anyone in the audience who would like to make a public comment to the council? Please raise your hand. Seeing no hands raised, there's no public comment.
All right. Motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Further discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Adjourn. Thank you.